danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 304 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me in Melrose, Massachusetts, is Nate Mavis.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here in Melrose, in your home with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you in my home. It's you're a very fine house guest, and it's super fun to record the show in person.
Yes, this is a rare treat for us and hopefully for listeners as well. But honestly, fuck them.
Yeah.
As long as we enjoy ourselves.
Yeah, we could do like a live thing and just invite random people to my living room just for a live taping of the podcast.
I took a walk around Melrose, Massachusetts, and this is probably a particularly beautiful day in Melrose, but it's a beautiful neighborhood.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's good in the summer. I like it. It's quiet. It's I think as I've said before, it has the amusing distinction of being close to work, but a place that many of my coworkers do not know exists.
Which is difficult to find in the Boston region. I think there's not a lot of undiscovered gems. It's a pretty efficient market.
It is, yeah, but it's small and it's highly residential and it's not very appealing if you don't have kids, I think. But yeah, I like it here. I'm glad you like it.
And so I have not actually been, I just got here late last night, so I've not been to the Encore yet, but you're quite close, like 15, 20 minute drive to the Encore?
It's wild. Yeah, it's 15 minutes.
Wow.
I
mean, you moved here before you knew, like, well, I know before you're not any, like planning your life around the Encore, but like, what a crazy thing to have a casino just like drop 15 minutes.
It's unbelievable. So first, like, it dominates the eastern skyline, like north.
That was
north,
strange.
It dominates, and that's like very jarring to me.
I took a lift from the airport yesterday, and like, so I mean, I used to live in Boston, so this is like a very familiar ride to me. And you sort of see like Charlestown. Is it called Bunker Hill?
But it's
not that Bunker Hill, but it's Bunker Hill.
Oh, it is that Bunker Hill.
Is that Bunker Hill?
It's that Bunker
what
Hill.
What am I confusing it with? I guess that wasn't in Lexington. Anyway, it's a Bunker Hill.
Yeah.
And so you see Bunker Hill, and you see like the tower, and you see Charlestown, and then all of a sudden you see like a thing that looks, it does, it looked literally exactly like the one in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But it's like been dropped onto the Boston sky. I was like,
it's so surreal.
I tried to take a picture with my phone, but it was dark and it was really blurry. So
it's just nuts. And like, no, not only did I not plan anything around this casino, but like, between the new job and everything, like I was riding the subway that you take to go to the casino on the subway, just coming home from work on its opening night. And I was like, why are there well-dressed people on this subway? You know? And it turned out it was opening night of the casino. Cause I just assumed it would be late, you know, like they say it'll open in 2019, but it's not going to open in 20. And then like all of a sudden there's I just wake up and there's a poker room. Like it's like a really nice poker room. It's great.
Yeah. This is the city with the big dig.
Yeah.
With 10 years behind schedule.
Yeah. And like, yeah, everything. Yeah. It's not. And like, you know, like who's to say the poker room's going to work? It's like, oh, surprise. They're taking $8 out of the pot. Like, I don't know. Like it could be, but I mean, they're not, but like, just the chances. I just thought it was better just to ignore it. And so I did. And then I woke up one day and there was a casino. And it's really close. I haven't lived this close to a casino since Arizona. And this might actually even be a little bit closer. It's great.
I'm looking forward to checking it out tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
One thing that was not the case in Arizona, like there I lived near a card room. Here I live near a casino. And like, you know, it's really a win. I mean, it looks nice. Like, I mean, if you care about these things, which I really don't, but like, it's really like sort of a glamorous hotel casino. It's very strange.
I mean, I care about them because I think a lot of the people that I want to be playing with care about them.
Yes.
Like, it's not, I mean, I actually kind of like the like slightly seedy is not quite the right word, but just like old-fashioned kind of feel of
bare
like
bones, yeah.
Lucky Chances or Commerce. Yeah. I think they have like I think they were probably both built in like the 70s or 80s, and they feel like it. And I think they don't have quite the polish of like I don't know Bellagio, Wynn, those places. A little bit give me the creeps.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot of people are into it. It all feels very like phony and silly to me.
Yeah, it's. No, I think we're on the same page there. I miss, like, when I lived in Arizona, like, now there's the Talking Stick Resort there. But when I was there, it was just a tent you could go play cards in. And it was wonderful. It was, like, half slot machines, and then some blackjack, and then a bunch of poker tables. And it was glorious. And it was dim, and the food was good and reasonably priced, and the action was good. And it was just a tent you could go play cards at. Those were the days.
I just find the contrast of, like, at the Wynn, especially if you're at the Wynn, this is the one in Las Vegas. I've not been to the one here yet. You're there on, like, a Friday or Saturday night. And, you know, I mean, most poker players look pretty schlubby, myself very much included. And then, like, the other people in the who are, like, going to the various clubs in the Wynn are wearing their, like, club wear, and they're all, like, dressed up and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and there is a stark contrast, but I just find, like, that kind of formal attire is so, just, like, so, like, people can't even walk in it, and, like, it's just
it's the very whole strange, thing.
Like, it just looks like people wearing Halloween costumes.
Yeah. And then, like, at the end of the night, if, like, you're playing a long session, like, they come out of the club at 2 in the morning, and they're sloppy, they're, like, playing penny slots in their, like, best dresses. Like, it's very strange. It's really very strange. So, welcome to Boston. Various people on Twitter are reminding you that there's a casino here.
Like, are you going to check out the... Yes, I think I will play some poker at that casino while I'm here.
Yeah. Noted poker author Andrew Brokus still makes time to play sometimes. That's good.
I really have not played much. I took that little trip to Commerce, which I guess we have not talked about on the air because it's been a little while since we did an episode.
How was the Commerce, Andrew?
I loved the Commerce. And I understand that a lot of people don't like it or have sort of a love-hate relationship with it. I didn't spend a lot of time playing there. I can understand what people don't like about it. I very well might grow to dislike more things about it if I spent more time there. But, I mean, it's just a freaking huge card room. Like, that's pretty exciting in its own right. And then, you know, there's just, like, there's good games going all the time. I find the way I've been thinking about this recently is like there's a lot of interesting people in the poker world, and like not all of them are safe to approach. It's a little like a zoo in that regard, you know, like you don't want to like make eye contact with all of them, but they're all interesting. Like I like seeing them. And Commerce definitely puts on a good show in terms of like exotic animals.
I mean, I've never had anything but good experiences there. And like the rules make sense. I thought like the floors were really quite good when I was there. I mean, the action is crazy great. You can get a game. I mean, and like also if you don't like too much glamour, Commerce does not deliver too much
glamour. You're not going to get over glamoured at the Commerce.
Yeah, no. You're not paying for the the A+ carpeting when you're there.
One of the things that I was really worried about was I just heard just that the parking lot was really like seedy and dangerous. I mean, and I was never there super late, but I mean, at like midnight, it was active. You know, like it didn't feel like sketchy walking to my car. Like there were plenty of people around who you know did not like. I don't know that it didn't feel like a city. Like it was much more populated than like the Rio parking lot late at night. Which I mean, I know there's been a couple of high profile robberies there, but like I don't know. I didn't really feel unsafe.
Yeah. Good. Glad you had a good trip. It's so you played some pretty high stakes there. You played some 10-20-40 there.
I did. I played 2-5, 5-10, 10-20, and 10-20-40 there. I was not blown away by the quality of the really big games, and this gets to an opinion that I have. I don't think anyone who plays really high stakes listens to the show anyway, so I don't have to worry too much about giving away this secret, and we've talked about it before, that like often the second highest stakes game in the room is the best game.
Oh, like for hourly?
Yeah.
Like, and oftentimes you can make a better hourly with much less downside risk. Like, right. I mean, with lower variance.
I mean, I do think even for a lot of professionals, secretly, like, would never admit to it, but a little bit want the variance.
Oh, like, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
they're,
yeah.
Like, a lot of live poker pros are, like, they have a gamble to them.
Yeah. And also, like, yeah. I mean, over in my part of the poker world, like, I've played a lot of Limit 08, which is a low variance game relative to basically every other form of poker. And, like, I've always wondered if one of the reasons that, like, really good pros stayed away from those games, like, A, at the stakes I was playing, the best pros were playing bigger. But they're, like, I played some great, like, 30-60 with a kill. Like, that's pretty nice game, you know? Like, and one thing is that variance applies to wins, too, you know? And, like, you know, like, I rarely lost a lot, but, like, it would be very common for me to rack up, you know, $317 ahead. And, like, eh, good session, you know? Like, not even that long a session. And, like, but, you know, then, like, one day you have a great session, you know? It's like, I won $675 this day. And I think that's it. I think a lot of the professionals, like, you know, like, they don't want to remove the possibility of walking away with an extra 10K.
Right. I mean, I think professional poker players are still poker players in that they're convinced that their best sessions are representative of what they're truly capable of.
Yeah.
And their worst sessions are just bad variants. And if they could just play a little bit better and run a little bit better, they would have those plus 10K sessions, you know, every time out.
Yeah. Yes, and I really agree that the second or even the third biggest game in the room can often have the highest hourly for the best players.
The other thing that I think confuses people or whatever about those bigger games is there will often be a whale. You know, like, there will be someone who is very bad at poker, like, worse than anyone who's sitting in, like, the 5-10 game, maybe even worse than anyone who's sitting in the 2-5 game, who's sitting in the 10-20-40 game.
Yeah.
It depends. Like, some of those people will sit with a lot of money. In the time that I was playing, like, there were two people who kind of fit that description.
Yeah.
Like, one of them had 5K in front of them, one of them had 2K in front of him. And I don't mean, like, I understand those are, like, large amounts of money. But for a 10-20-40 game, which is an uncapped buy-in, like, all of the good players had much more money than that on the table.
Yeah.
And it's not, like, relative to the blinds, it's not a particularly deep buy-in. Like, when you are dividing that amount of money, like, it's not that much bigger than the kind of stacks you're going to see at a 5-10 table. So if we're talking about, like, how much are you winning from the weakest players in the game, I think it matters a lot. Like, so I think a lot of people are just attracted because they're like, oh, that one big fish is sitting at 10-20-40.
Yeah.
And, like, if you're not better than most of the other people at that table, I don't think it's that great of a spot for you. If you could otherwise sit in, and I mean, this is, like, you can ignore these numbers and apply it to whatever stakes you play. Like, but if you could otherwise sit in a 5-10 game and be definitively the best player at the table, or go sit in a bigger game where there's one very bad player and then you're maybe, like, the fourth or fifth best player at the table.
Yeah.
It's unlikely that that's a better spot for you than the 5-10. This might even be true if you're only going to be, like, the third best player at the table.
Yeah, that's right. So, a couple things about that. First, there's a special skill to sort of playing defense against really good players that a lot of people have not cultivated. And some people are really good at that. And playing defense does not mean just checking and calling. Often it means the opposite of that. So, like, learning how not to lose too much against great players, it's a whole separate thing. And if you haven't specifically cultivated that skill, that should really go into your decision-making in this scenario.
Can I just say, my book, Play Optimal Poker, is a great way to cultivate that skill?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like as I start to understand, or really, like, when I started to understand game theory better is when I started to feel more comfortable having elite players at my table.
Yeah.
Where I was just like, I just feel like there's a limit to how bad a spot I'm going to get into.
Yep.
I feel like I'm going to understand enough to, like, not make a huge mistake to those players, barring fatigue.
Yeah.
and so there's just, like, there's a comfort in that. There's just like, okay, I know that there's a lot of upside coming from seat 6, and even if seat 8 is, like, a really good player, I know that he's not going to outplay me by that much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of reasons to read your book, but that's one of them, yeah. But second, if there's any chance you're playing your B game instead of your A game, or really if there's any chance you have your C game on, then like you so much want to be like either not playing at all or not playing the biggest game, yeah. or because like just not like the downside to you of playing less than your best manifests so much, like it gets exploited so much worse, like you're just not going to be punished for it nearly as hard, nearly as often.
You're not going to get as many opportunities to play your C game. Like, yeah. you know, let's say your C game manifests itself as making bad calls.
Yeah.
Right? Your opponents in a softer game are not going to value bet as thinly
yep.
as they are in a bigger game. And, like, in a bigger game, you're going to face big, thin value bets. And if you're calling too much, you're going to call and lose to those bets. And you wouldn't, even if you were ready to make the same mistake at 5-10, like your 5-10 opponents might not find those value. Some of them aren't going to find those value bets.
Yeah.
And so you just don't get that downside.
Well said. Well said. Want to talk about some strategy?
I do, but I want to tell the people that our strategy segment is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. We've been talking about cash game strategy, and our strategy hand is going to deal with cash game strategy. But if you're interested in tournament strategy, where you can't just choose the table and the stakes that you want to play at, then check out tournamentpokeredge.com. You'll find hundreds of videos from myself and many other instructors, many of whom have been guests on this very show. So if you like the strategy that you hear here, you will love the strategy that you hear on tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy hand is coming to us from Jesse. Jesse says, "Hey guys, super long time listener. Listen to every episode twice and several episodes more."
Wow.
Yes, thank you, Jesse. We are very flattered. I recently played a hand online at Global Poker and found myself in a very interesting spot. I have consorted with my poker texting groups and have received mixed answers, hoping for a little more clarity from you guys. The hand is from a 6-max 5-10 no-limit cash session. Effective stacks are $1,200. Action folds to hero on the button, who opens to $25 with ace-3 offsuit. What are your thoughts on the preflop open?
Whatever.
yeah,
it's a bad much. Hand, but you're supposed to open some bad hands on the button. And the ace is a good card. So there's that. Like, if you were to, like, some people in some spots will have a bigger opening size on the button. If you do that, then open folding this hand is no crime at all. Also, could be a hand you can put just fine into a $30 opening range, but it's like much more marginal in that situation. Yeah, it's a bad hand you're raising with. If your opponents will three bet you too much, or maybe even against certain opponents who will just call you too much, then play okay later, folding is fine. Yeah, as usual with these like hands that are near the bottom of your opening ranges, you should think about what's going to happen later, and there can be reasons for you to turn them into folds, and you should be thinking about sort of what your overall range looks like instead of like, you know, how do I play ace-3? So yeah, opening to $25 on the button with some set of hands makes sense to me. Putting ace-3 offsuit in that set also makes sense to me. So, okay. What do you think?
I believe, and this is very consistent with what you just said. I believe Poker Snowy plays this as a mix for a 2.5x open, which is interesting because I, for a long time, believed that like any ace on the button you should be opening. And I think, I mean, that probably was true in the games that I was playing in, especially like years ago. People were probably not defending their blinds as much as they should, and in particular, not three betting as much as they should.
Yeah.
I think in practice, if you're playing, so rake is also going to be a big deal here. If you're playing in a game like at Commerce, where the pot is raked preflop, this is probably a fold.
Yeah.
If you're playing in a game that's raked postflop, it could still be a fold. If you're playing in a timed game, it's almost certainly an open. I do think it's good to understand, as you were articulating, Nate, what are the things that make it a mix? All right, so sorry to keep plugging the book, but this is one of the things that I mentioned in Play Optimal Poker is when you see a solver, which Poker Snowy is not quite a solver, but it's very similar. When you see a solver tell you that something is a mix, what that means is that if your opponents play perfectly, you're going to be indifferent between either opening or, in this case, folding. Those are the two things that are mixed. So those are going to have the same expected value if your opponents play perfectly. If your opponents don't play perfectly, one of those options is likely to be better than the other. You may not be able to anticipate which one is which, but I think it's good to understand what are the things that would make this a more or less profitable open. And by far the biggest one is the frequency with which you get 3-bet. If you get 3-bet, you're going to have to fold this hand. And if you have too many hands, like if you open every single time you had an ace on the button, you would simply be unable to defend your range to aggressive 3-bets from the blinds. You would just end up having to fold too often or playing too weak of a range. If you did, like if you tried to expand your calling range against those 3-bets, you just end up with bigger problems down the line. So that's the reason why you would mix this at equilibrium. But if your opponents aren't 3-betting enough and there's not like rake or you know, significant rake factors to consider, then this is likely going to be profitable because only aggressive 3-betting is sufficient to make you indifferent between raising and folding this hand. I mean, that's also assuming you're going to play reasonably well after the flop.
Yep.
The less comfortable you are playing after the flop, the more inclined you should be to fold this. Like, you're definitely not giving up a lot, even if you are going to play it perfectly after the flop. So if you're not going to play it, like, if you think that your opponents in the blinds are, like, better post-flop players than you are, I think folding this would also be good.
Yep.
So, Jesse opens to $25, which he has our permission to do at least sometimes. The big blind defends, and we see a flop. He says $55 in the pot, so I'm not sure. I guess with Global Poker, they're not taking rake. I think the structure on Global Poker is... I'm not entirely sure how it works at Global Poker. I've never played there.
Me neither.
Okay. Anyway, approximately, or maybe exactly, $55 in the pot. The flop is deuce, tray, four, all spades, and our hero has the ace of spades in his hand. So he's holding ace three with the ace of spades. The flop is 2-3-4, all spades. Big blind checks. Our hero bets $20. How do we like that?
So that's one thing we've talked about recently, is how a lot of flop betting can be small. So on this board, I would tend to have a larger c-betting size, but that could be wrong. I think, as usual, the most important thing is, you know, it's quite important to pick the size that's right for your range and coordinate the size and the range. So one advantage of a $20 bet is that it helps you realize some equity. With a lot of the folds you get, you're going to be happy about that. And, you know, the big blind will have a lot of hands that need to fold, many of which will be folding away equity. And you also give yourself, a better price on the bluff, and it also makes it easier for you to get called from hands that are worse than you. Like, if you have, say, you opened, pocket sixes, or, like the ace three, that's a good example. Let's say you open the ace three and you have a pair of threes. If you bet small, like, you're going to get called by ace and king high. That's nice. So that's that. I would bet this hand. I mean, there are some arguments for checking, but I don't like them. You're going to want to fold. Like, a lot of the hands that fold, you'll be very happy about that. A lot of them have six outs against you, so that's good. You don't have like an extremely playable hand later, although you do have the nut flush draw, which changes a lot, which I haven't mentioned yet. So I guess maybe you should be checking. So you do want to check behind the ace of spades sometimes. So which ace of spades hands do you want to check behind? This is getting complicated. My point is, you do want to bet $20 sometimes. I think this is a great hand to bet $20 with. I'm now suspecting that this is like a mix where having this ace of spades in your checking range, like, there are really good reasons to bet it. And I think I probably would default to a small bet. But please be sure to check the ace of spades sometimes. And I'm not sure whether this is an appropriate ace of spades to do that with ever.
Almost everything is a mix. Like, yeah. When we're talking about like flop c-betting in a button versus big blind spot, it's quite possible that there are going to be no pure strategies if we just looked at it in PioSolver. I think this, just to start with the question of bet size, because I have an easier answer to that question. I think that small bets tend to be better on monotone boards. I think monotone boards and paired boards have in common the fact that more so than on other boards, there are a couple of really important cards. So obviously, like on a three spade board, the ace of spades is a super important card. And the problem is there's only one ace of spades in the deck. So it's hard, at least especially in these situations where both players have really wide ranges, it's hard to block the ace of spades unless you just have the ace of spades in your hand.
Yeah.
In which case, you're not really bluffing. Like, anytime you have the ace of spades in your hand on a flop with three spades, you have a pretty good hand. I mean, yeah. Sometimes you have more or less preference for folds, but you always have a quite good hand. And what that also means is that you're never going to be able to present your opponent with a difficult decision when he has the ace of spades in his hand. Like, it's never going to be wrong for him to put money in the pot with the ace of spades in his hand on a flop like this. So, like, your best bluffs would block him having the ace of spades, but when his range is so wide, you can't really do that. What that means is that it's hard for you to bet, to value bet or bluff confidently for a large size when you're not blocking one of those really key cards in your opponent's hand. Because if you make a large bet, it's very easy for him to just like continue when he has a key card and fold when he doesn't. And he doesn't really have to worry about overfolding in those situations because he, like, when he has like just enough of his range, I guess, is going to have those cards that you're not really pressuring a lot of his, like, his range. He can just sort of fold when he doesn't have those cards and call when he does, and he's going to end up playing reasonably well. Like, you're not really giving him difficult decisions with a large bet size.
Yeah.
A small bet size forces him to, like, he is going to end up overfolding if he just folds every time he doesn't have the ace or king of spades in his hand, or have like a set or something on this board. Like, if he just kind of plays, I just play my strongest spades and my strongest made hands and nothing else. Like, that's a strategy that would work reasonably well against a large c-bet size. It would not work so well against a small c-bet size. So a small c-bet forces him to defend more marginal hands in his range or fold away his equity. And this, like many hands in our range, is very happy to get either of those outcomes. So if the opponent chooses to just like take and fold all of those hands that are like king, queen of diamonds kind of stuff, or maybe that's a slightly too strong hand that he would have three bet preflop, but like king, jack of diamonds or king, queen offsuit, whatever. If, you know, if the opponent just chooses to fold those hands, that's fine. You know, he's folding away at least like 15-ish% equity in the pot. If he chooses to call with those hands, we're a very big favorite against them, so that's fine too. Even getting a small, even against a small bet size, he doesn't have quite the right price to continue with our exact hand. So we're sort of, and there's like plenty of good things that could happen later. We might bluff him out later. We might, you know, maybe the king of spades comes and he puts another bet into the pot. Like, a lot of things could happen on a later street. So yeah, like I think we just get a lot of folds we don't particularly want if we make a large bet size. And when we make a small bet size, we get folds that we do want, and we also get calls that we do want. Mm-hmm. So I like his decision to bet small, at least with this hand. Probably, like, there's not going to be a lot of big c-betting on this board, period. If we gave PioSolver, like, options of using different size bets, especially when it has the ace of spades in its hand, because, again, because it is such a key card, Nate, what you were saying about wanting to mix that between sometimes having it in our checking range, sometimes in betting range, sometimes in big betting range. It's probably going to show up in all of them. It's probably going to mix all of its ace of spade. Like, it's not going to say, well, ace eight is better for checking and ace three is better for betting, because then like an eight or a three becomes a relevant blocker for the opponent. So like, it's probably just going to mix across all of its combinations. Like, it's sometimes going to check ace three and sometimes bet it, sometimes check ace eight, sometimes bet it.
Yep. I like that a lot.
In terms of mistakes your opponents are actually going to make, I think, you know, the kind of to boil it down, like, I think the small bet is more likely to generate. It's a much harder strategy for your opponent to find a defense against a small C bet than a big C bet. So even like, ignoring whatever PioSolver would do, like, your real life opponents are going to struggle a lot more to find a good response to a small C bet than a big one. So our hero bets $20, and the opponent calls, putting $95 in the pot. The turn is the 10 of clubs. Villain checks. What do we want to do now?
You got called. Now I want to check. He could have easily checked and called with many hands that are better than yours, and certainly a lot that are worse than yours. A lot of those are going to fold now. You have the ace of spades. I think there are going to be other Ace of Spades hands I'd rather barrel with, I think. So, yeah, I like checking now. I like checking now. What do you think?
So I'm currently working on a sequel to Play Optimal Poker, and one of the things that I'm... So this has been on my mind a lot recently is thinking about the value of betting on earlier streets and, like, what's happening. It's like the first edition of, or the first Play Optimal Poker book talks a lot about, like, polarized ranges, which is most relevant on later streets. On the flop, one of the things that's happening, so it's not just, like, either a hand is a value bet or a hand is a bluff, right? Especially when we're c-betting the flop, one of the things that's happening, we mentioned this in the context of having a hand like king-queen of diamonds fold to a flop bet here, is even when we're ahead, we're still gaining protection, right? We're gaining from having the opponent fold live outs. I think people tend to focus too much on protecting against really strong draws. You know, people will look and they'll see a flush draw on the board and they think, I have to protect against that. Like, no one's folding a flush draw on the flop. You're not, I mean, you might be getting value from it. You're not really protecting against it by betting. You are protecting, though, again, you know, so, I mean, that's why I'm using the example of, like, king, queen of diamonds on this board. It's a hand that does have equity against you. Very realistically, it'll fold. So, like, part of the value of betting the flop, you know, you haven't flopped the nuts. You have a draw of the nuts, but right now you just have a pair of threes. So, you know, you haven't flopped a super strong hand that you want to play a large pot with yet. You may end up with a hand you want to play a large pot with, but you don't have a particularly strong hand yet. I mean, it's good for a button versus big blind spot, but it's far from the nuts. You also don't have a hand that's going to make any better hands fold. Like, it's quite unlikely your opponent's folding anything better than ace three on this to a small bet on the flop. So the flop bet is, like, not real clearly a bluff or a value bet. Its value comes from a variety of things. It has decent equity when called. It's happy to get the folds. And because it also has a nut flush draw, it is sometimes generating value by making the pot larger so that when you get there, you can make, like, you know, larger value bets with the nuts. So importantly, it's not quite the nuts on this board, right? There is a straight flush that's possible, even now on the flop. So I think when we're talking about whether to bet the turn, a lot of the arguments for betting the flop don't apply anymore. Like, we got the protection we were going to get. Like, the king, queen of diamonds has most likely already folded. So betting to make the opponent fold live over cards was relevant on the flop, and it's not relevant now on the turn. I do think in a button versus big blind spot, you know, ace three might be, especially on a board where opponent has incentive to call with so much ace high, because, you know, he might just be thinking a hand like ace jack is often good, which it should be, and has, even without a spade in his hand, he just has, like, a draw to a straight, which is decent. So, I mean, it could be that ace three, we can still get some thin value on the turn. I think there's a decent case for betting it, but not nearly as strong of a case as there is for betting the flop. And I think you're right, Nate, that we're gonna have, like, if we had ace eight with the ace of spades, that's a hand where we'd be more interested in generating folds. And so, you know, when we're bluffing, if we are going to start betting a more polarized range on the turn, which I think we should, I think we're going to have a lot of other ace of spades hands that are going to slot more clearly as bluffs.
Good. I like it.
So it does go check, check. Good job, Jesse. And the river is the five of spades. There is $95 in the pot. Our hero is holding a straight flush. The board is 2, 3, 4 all spades, 10 of clubs, 5 of spades. All right, we got a straight flush. That's pretty exciting.
It's a good hand.
Villain bets $335. We started 1,200 effective, so there's still about $800 behind. Call or shove? Or fold?
There are people I'd fold this against, but I think it's a pretty clear call. Can you get paid off by the... So, what would Tommy Angelo say? Or what would many people say? But something I associate with Tommy Angelo. It's like, are you going to get paid off by the third nuts or worse? And then sort of adjust that for... Like, would the third nuts have really chosen this sizing? And so, I don't see a lot of value in a raise. You have a straight flush. That's great. But also... Yeah, it's just, it's as old as the theory of poker, or even older. Like, it's not about how likely you are to have the best hand, which in this case is already, you know, it's a little dicey. Like, I want to call this bet, but you do not win 100% of the time. And when you raise and get called, you win less than 50% of the time. So, I think it's a call. And then if this hand happens at the encore or any live room with a jackpot in a jackpot game, you win or you lose the pot. Then you take your bathroom break so you don't have to hear people talking about how close you got to hitting the jackpot and if you'd only been playing two cards instead of one card. So you call the bet, you win or you lose, and then you leave the table. That's my strategy for this spot.
Some solid six street analysis there. Yeah, I would really take raising off the table almost immediately. And this is part of why I thought this was an interesting hand to discuss. I think it's really common for people to overvalue the second nuts, especially in a situation where all it takes is one card. Like this, in some sense, this is a lot lower than the second nuts because we're losing to ace x six of spades, king x six of spades, queen x six of spades, seven x six of spades, jack x six of spades. Like there's a lot of different ways our opponent could have the six of spades in his hand, right? We don't really have, I mean, the second nuts kind of implies like there's only one combination that beats you or something like that. Like there's quite a few combinations of hands that beat us.
Yeah, in fairness, a lot of those fold before the flop, but then they don't fold.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more critical thing is that when the villain overbets, especially with such a large overbet, I would expect him to be extremely polarized. Like, I would expect to see a straight flush or a bluff in this situation.
Yeah.
And the main reason I like calling with this hand is not because we have a straight flush, but because we have a blocker to the straight flush.
Yeah.
Now, it just so happens that having a blocker to a straight flush means we have a straight flush.
Yeah.
But if the opponent has a balanced river, a balanced polarized range on the river, which he very well may not. Like a lot of people are not balanced when they bet three times the pot. So yeah. What you said about like there are people I'd fold this to, I think is absolutely right.
Yeah.
But if the villain has a balanced betting strategy on the river, then he should, you know, assuming no knowledge of our hand, he should have enough bluffs to make us indifferent to calling the times that he has the ace or the six of spades. The thing is, when we have the ace of spades in our hand, we're blocking a bunch of his value hands, which means he's going to end up being bluff heavy. And so this would be a plus EV call rather than a zero EV call as a different, like if we had the king of spades, I would say that's much more likely to be. I mean, that probably still has a little bit of a blocker effect because he's more likely to play two spade hands than one, but it's a much weaker blocker effect than holding the ace of spades. That's assuming he would even overbet the ace of spades for value, which again, some people might not.
Yeah.
I would call, but I'd be thinking of my hand more as a bluff catcher than as a like value hand. I think that's just, you know, if you get wrapped up in just seeing the absolute value of the hand as straight flush, it seems crazy to say like, oh, I'm just going to call with a straight flush on the river. But I'm reminded of a quote that I don't know if it's original to you, but I definitely got it from you. It's hard to make quads, but sometimes the board does most of the work.
Yeah. Same. I think, yeah. I don't know if it's original to me, but it felt like I was making it up. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, this is a board where it's not particularly difficult to make a straight flush. Like, both you and your opponent should have a fair number of straight flush combinations in your range. So it's not just, you can't just shrug and be like, well, I have a straight flush. You know, straight flush under straight flush, all the money goes in. Like, what can you do?
Yeah.
I mean, if you could tell the story that way, and your backers, you know, if they didn't ask for a hand history, like, they'd probably be pretty convinced by that, but...
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, think about, what's that stud game? Low in the hole stud, where the low spade in the hole gets half the pot. It's like pretty often somebody has the deuce of spades in the hole. It's like that. Deal this board, and then deal some hands. People are going to get some straight flushes.
So results, our hero did just call, and the reason he wrote is that he said a lot of the people that he shared the hand with thought he should have jammed the river and was crazy not to call. I think those people are crazy. If you told me I had to either shove or fold, I would fold, and I don't think it's even close.
Not even close to being close, yeah.
Now, so the results here are really weird, and I don't know how to explain this. The villain had the queen of spades.
Huh.
Which just strikes me as an atrocious bet. Like, it's too strong of a hand to turn into a bluff. It could maybe be a check raise bluff on the river, but it has way too much showdown value to just overbet as a bluff. It's not nearly strong enough to over. Like, we're talking about whether or not we're going to call it the ace of spades. There's no way I'm calling this river bet with, like, a bear jack of spades.
Yeah. It's really bad.
But that still doesn't prove that he was going to call a shove with it. Like, I still think there's a fair chance if you jam, he's not calling with anything worse than your hand.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like, I mean, do you want to bluff raise this river ever?
No, that's the thing. I mean, that comes back to my point about how hard it is to block. Enough. Like, when he overbets here, we can never really block his nut flushes, block his straight flushes, which means it's hard to jam. Like, it's hard to choose what our bluffing candidates would be, because if we don't have a straight flush card in our hand, then it's so easy for him to have it that it's hard to raise the spot as a bluff.
Yeah, and yeah, he can't. He's not going to call. I, with all respect to people who you talked about this hand with, it is not close. You played it very well, though. You played, it's a well-played hand on every street, I think. So, well done. Well done.
Yeah, I agree. Very, very well played and very well thought through. And I agree. It's like a tricky spot. I mean, I can remember times in my poker career where I did like over. I mean, this is relevant not just on straight flush boards. I think in general, like when there's four flush cards on the board, people are way too willing to put money in the pot when they just have like the jack or queen of that suit. And they're just like, oh, cooler. What are you going to do? Like, I'm sure we've all seen
flush.
That. Yeah, exactly. Like, there's a lot of spots where like it's really not relevant that you have the jack of spades when you're facing a large bet on a four spade river.
Yeah.
Like, if you might as well be calling with the deuce of spades, which could be correct. I mean, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad call, but just having that card in your hand is not making the decision for you, or it shouldn't be.
Yep.
Thanks for writing, Jesse. Thanks for listening, everybody. Anything else you want to talk about, Nate?
I think that'll do it. But, you know, there should be a flurry of recording. You know, Andrew is right here. He is sleeping under my roof. It's very exciting.
Actually, let's tell people, because I announced this in my email newsletter, which, by the way, if you are not a subscriber already, thinkingpoker.net/newsletter. I send out occasional updates. They always include some strategy content. And then I also let you know about, you know, if we have a new thing available, or sometimes even just like you get exclusive first looks at things that are in the works. But the newsletter has had access to this information for 2 weeks now. So we can tell, maybe it's just 1 week. But either way, we can tell everyone else now. We've been working on a series of premium podcasts called Weekend Warrior, now that Nate is a Weekend Warrior.
Yes.
And this is targeted specifically for people who are not professional poker players, but take their poker very seriously, and you have limited time to put into poker and you want to make the most of it. So the question is, if you're playing against professionals, how do you hold your own? Like, you're playing with people who are between, you know, studying and playing, they're getting in 40-ish hours of practice a week, and you're lucky if you can find 10 or 15, how do you hold your own against those people? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the impetus. But you know, we're talking a lot about hands that you've played at the new Wynn and our Encore.
Yes.
And some hands probably that I'll play at the Encore this weekend.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's some of the best stuff we've ever made. I could be wrong. Like, maybe it's just that it helps me a lot and I like it.
if it helps you, it's going to help people who are listening to this show.
Yeah, I really like it. And this could be that the people who email us and, you know, track us down in casinos and so on and say hi are disproportionately, you know, sort of fit this mold. I think a lot of you at least approximately fit some part of that description. And I think there are a lot of things that can really, really, really help you out. Playing your best game, you know, thinking about strategy when you might be rusty on some things, thinking about strategy and how it's changed, you know, that you might not have noticed.
That's a huge one. I think a lot of people who are not, like, I mean, if you're only playing 10 or 15 hours a week, it's hard to keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening now. And I think there's a lot of people who are still thinking about like stuff as standard that was standard in like 2014.
Yeah.
And even I'm guilty of that to some degree. Like, I know, like, when I play online, I know I'm not really like quite up to where like European pros who are like playing online every day are.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of people who are just like, oh yeah, that's Harrington. Like, Harrington's books are 10 years old.
Yeah. Some of them are more than 10 years old. Yeah. Yeah, I think, I find myself thinking things, like, when I hit, and I don't want to disparage anyone, but, like, when you hit a regular or a professional who you think is maybe at a good level in 2-5 and is sort of like a B-plus professional, like, I find myself just reflexively thinking, like, oh, he checked behind on the flop as the pre-flop raiser. He never has a flush draw or something.
Yeah.
And, like, that was much more true 5 years ago than it is now. It's like, what? That guy checks a flush. What? Like, so, for more observations like that and a lot of really in-depth breakdowns of hands and what I immodestly think is some pretty good stuff. Weekend Warrior, coming soon.
Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.